Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 316, Side B, titled Update on the Politics of SV40. This is being recorded on July 22nd of the year 2001. In the first side of this program, we dealt with, among other things, two articles in successive Sunday editions of the San Francisco Chronicle, both of them by William Carlson, C-A-R-L-S-E-N, the Chronicle science writer, and both of those dealing with the SV40 cancer-causing monkey viral contaminant in the original polio vaccine. And in turn, those articles supplemented the February 2000 article in the Atlantic Monthly by Debbie Bookshin and Jim Schumacher. And in turn, that supplemented the remarkable research of Ed Haslam and his very, very important book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, The Story of an Underground Medical Laboratory, published in soft cover by the Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995, at least the initial edition. Ed has published a couple of follow-up editions, and the most recent edition was copyright 1997. And after summarizing Ed's argument in which he connected research into the SV40 viral contaminant with, in turn, the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman, an associate of, among others, David Ferry in New Orleans. Dr. Mary Sherman was murdered just before the Warren Commission came to New Orleans to take testimony. And in turn, Ed has developed a very convincing hypothesis that a cancer treatise that was found in Ferry's apartment was in all likelihood written by Sarah Stewart. And Ed has connected the research into attempts to use a linear particle accelerator to produce a genetically mutated version of SV40 that could be used to create an anti-cancer vaccine to inoculate the American people against cancer. Ed has connected that research to the milieu of the Kennedy assassination, the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman, Dr. Alton Oxner, one of the most powerful figures in 20th century American medicine and also an arch-reactionary political operative, who in turn was the driving force behind the Information Council for the Americas. That was a right-wing intelligence outfit with strong connections to the intelligence community, which did an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald in the summer of 1963, in which Oswald proclaimed his communist sympathies. What I'm going to do now is to excerpt some portions of Ed Haslam's Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus dealing with the SV40 contamination of the polio vaccine, and we're not only going to review the substance of Ed's research here by way of fleshing this out for newer listeners, but we're also going to come across a couple of names that were part of the Alton Oxner, Mary Sherman, New Orleans, National Institute of Health, National Cancer Institute milieu, that's the major focal point of Ed Haslam's book, and we're going to take a look at where they have ended up today. Now, two of the names that we're going to update in terms of contemporary connections are Dr. Ruth Kirstein, K-I-R-C-H-S-T-E-I-N, and her husband, Dr. Al Rabson, or Alan Rabson, last name R-A-B-S-O-N. So as you listen to these excerpts of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, pay particular attention to the names Dr. Ruth Kirstein and Dr. Alan Rabson. They are, by the way, now husband and wife. We're going to come back to where those two people have ended up within the National Institutes of Health after reviewing sections of Ed Haslam's book. This is from the most recent, updated edition of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. This is copyright 1997 by the Wordsworth Press. Its ISBN number is 0-964-3981-2-5. And after discussing the flap that surrounded the discovery of the SV40 contamination of the polio vaccine and attempts at verifying the safety of the vaccine, those attempts proved it to most unsuccessful, and after discussing Bernice Eddy's pioneering research for the National Institute of Health on the SV40 contaminant, Ed Haslam writes as follows. In the aftermath of the debacle, Bernice Eddy was taken off of polio research and transferred to the influenza section by the thankless NIH management. She shared her frustrations with a small group of women scientists who ate brown bag lunches on the steps of one of the laboratories. There, Eddy met a tenacious woman scientist named Sarah Stewart, who was waging her own battle against the official paradigms of bureaucratic medicine. Bernice Eddy and Sarah Stewart became close friends. Sarah Stewart's name remains virtually unknown today, despite her huge contribution to modern medicine. Not only did she prove that some cancers were caused by viruses, but subsequent research on the virus she discovered led to the discovery of DNA recombination, which is the most powerful tool in medical research today. Raised in the fertile Rio Grande Valley on the Mexican border, Stewart's educational odyssey ranged from the New Mexico Agricultural College in 1927 to getting a Ph.D. in bacteriology from the University of Chicago in 1939. Next, Stewart went to work for the National Institute of Health as a bacteriologist for 5 years. Believing that having a Ph.D. instead of an M.D. was holding back her career advancement, she entered Georgetown Medical School and earned her M.D. in 1947. Then she joined the National Cancer Institute and stayed there until reassigned to the U.S. Public Health Service in 1960. From the beginning, Sarah Stewart promoted the idea that cancer was caused by viruses. Due to this, she was not well accepted by the NIH or NCI staffs, who described her as, quote, an eccentric lady, unquote, determined to prove her theory was right. No one believed her, unquote. That from NCI documents. Finally, she was given access to an NCI laboratory in Bethesda, Maryland, where she could try to prove her theories. In 1953, she almost succeeded, but her work was not accepted by the ruling crowd at NIH. They found her methods sloppy and objected to the fact that she did not culture her viruses. So in 1956, her lunch partner Bernice Eddy showed Sarah Stewart how to grow her viruses in a culture of mouse cells. She now had all the ingredients she needed and began a series of experiments which are called classic, unquote, by modern-day National Institute of Health researchers. As her work progressed, she realized that she stood on the edge of an extremely important discovery and became very protective of her techniques. In staff presentations, she would bewilder NIH pathologists by showing them slides of things they had never seen before. Listen to the name Alan Rabson here. Pay particular attention to it. We're going to come back to it later in the discussion. Then, when they asked how she produced her results, she would giggle and say, "It's a secret," unquote. To quote her supervisor, Alan Rabson, R-A-B-S-O-N, quote, "She drove everybody crazy," unquote. And we're going to come back to Alan Rabson and where he has ended up in the medical establishment, or the government medical establishment, later in the program. Skipping down and resuming with Ed Haslam's text. The next passage of Ed's discussion here discusses Sarah Stewart's discovery of a cancer-causing monkey virus, Sarah Stewart and Bernice Eddy's discovery of a cancer-causing virus, rather called the polyoma virus, which in turn is basically virtually the same virus as SV40. SV40, again, simian virus 40, is a monkey-specific version of polyoma. They are virtually identical, and polyoma was proved in experimental trials to cause multiple types of cancers in a variety of different animals. And basically, for all intents and purposes, SV40 is a monkey variant of the polyoma. Of the Bernice, Eddy, and Sarah Stewart discovery of polyoma, we read, "In 1957, Stewart and Eddy discovered the polyoma virus, which produced several types of cancer in a variety of small mammals. Polyoma proved that some cancers were indeed caused by viruses. Her discovery officially threw open the doors of cancer virology. As Rabson phrased it, quote, suddenly, the whole place just exploded after Sarah found polyoma," unquote. Basically, the fact that viruses can cause cancer was unknown prior to, was not accepted, I should say, prior to this. Continuing with Ed's text, "It was the beginning of a new era of hope, but it raised some dark questions about earlier deeds. Before long, Yale's laboratory discovered that the polyoma virus had that," Yale's laboratory discovered that the polyoma virus that had produced the cancer in Stewart's mice and hamsters turned out to be virtually identical to simian virus number 40, or SV40, a monkey virus that caused cancer. In June of 1959, Bernice Eddy, who was still officially assigned to the flu vaccine project, began thinking about the polio vaccine again. This time, she was worried about something much deeper than polio. The vaccine's manufacturers had grown their polioviruses on the kidneys of monkeys, and when they removed the poliovirus from the monkeys' kidneys, They also removed an unknown number of other monkey viruses. The more they looked, the more they found. The medical science of the day knew little about the behavior or consequences of these monkey viruses, but times were changing. Confronted with mounting evidence that some monkey viruses caused cancer, Eddie grew suspicious of the polio vaccine and asked the excruciating question, had they inoculated an entire generation of Americans with cancer-causing monkey viruses? She conducted her research quietly, without alerting her NIH supervisors. In October of 1960, Eddie gave a talk to the Cancer Society in New York, and without warning NIH in advance, announced she had examined cells from the monkey kidneys in which the poliovirus was grown and had found that they were infected with cancer-causing viruses. Her inference was clear. There were cancer-causing monkey viruses in the polio vaccine. This was tantamount to forecasting an epidemic of cancer in America. When the word got back to her NIH bosses, they exploded in anger. When the cussing stopped, they crushed Bernice Eddy professionally. Any mention of cancer-causing monkey viruses in the polio vaccine was not welcomed by NIH. They took away her lab, destroyed her animals, put her under a gag order, prevented her from attending professional meetings, and delayed publication of her scientific papers. In the words of Edward Shorter, author of The Health Century, quote, her treatment became a scandal within the scientific community, unquote. Later, it became the subject of a congressional inquiry. In the words of Dr. Lawrence Killam, a fellow NIH researcher who wrote a letter of protest to the U.S. Surgeon General's office, quote, the presence of a cancer virus in the poliovirus vaccine is the matter demanding full investigation, unquote. And skipping down further, after discussing some other researchers, including of Maurice Hilleman, who was discussed in the Chronicle article of 7/15/2001, it is difficult for those of us who have seen the enormous press coverage of AIDS in the 1990s to understand the indolent response of the 1960s press on this subject. Was it really their job to prevent public panic? Did they cower in the face of scientific authority? Were they lazy, or stupid, or arrogant? Or were they told not to run the story by powerful political forces? It's hard to say, but there is evidence that the word leaked out anyway. In the spring of 1961, one of Eddie's co-workers published a medical article which said that there was live SV40 in the polio vaccine. Eddie herself confirmed that the SV40 monkey virus was causing cancer in hamsters as well as monkeys, proving that it was capable of crossing the zoonotic species barrier. But she was not allowed to release the information until a year later. NIH notified the U.S. Surgeon General that, quote, future polio vaccines would be free of SV40, unquote. On July 26, 1961, the New York Times reported two vaccine manufacturers were withdrawing their polio vaccines, quote, until they can eliminate a monkey virus, unquote. The article ran on page 33 with no mention of cancer. 7 months later, a second article in the New York Times mentioned the possibility of cancer in the polio vaccine. That article ran on page 27. There, the story died, and the specter of an approaching epidemic of cancer silently rose on the horizon. On the heels of the polio fiasco, the medical hierarchy feared the judgment of the masses. Their ability to destroy a painstakingly constructed scientific career overnight had been clearly proven. Another spat of bad news might shatter the public's confidence in vaccines altogether. Where would the world be then? Where would the public health establishment be then? As SV40 discoverer Maurice Hilleman put it, the government kept the contamination of the polio vaccine secret to, quote, avoid public hysteria, unquote. And after discussing in detail his data concerning an epidemic of cancer that is being downplayed, if not ignored, including soft tissue cancers, and that's one of the central elements of Ed Haslam's hypothesis, Ed goes on to discuss Bernice Eddy, Sarah Stewart, Mary Sherman, connections to the milieu of Alton Oxner, and again, we're going to hear a couple of interesting names, Ruth Kirstein and Alan Rabson, that we're going to come back to. Bernice Eddy obviously thought the possibility of an epidemic of viral cancer was real. Why else would she have risked her career and her pension by announcing her findings to the medical community without NIH's knowledge? Did she fear that political interests at NIH would bury her warning like they did when she sent them photos of the monkeys paralyzed by Salk's vaccine? Or was she just concerned that the glacially slow gears of bureaucratic science would not move fast enough to produce a solution in time? It may already have been too late. The viral damage to the genetic structure of the cell may take place very early in the infection. In 1959, Eddie explained it this way. It may be that the virus starts the cancerous process, but by the time we detect the tumor, there is so little virus left in an altered form that we cannot detect it, unquote. In 1995, it was explained this way. If the growth-controlling RAS gene, it's spelled R-A-S, is somehow damaged, it may become stuck in the on position. Either way, there was no possible political benefit to be gained from telling the public about Eddie's forecasted epidemic of cancer unless a vaccine could be developed in time to prevent it. The issue was speed. Developing a vaccine against a spectrum of cancer-causing monkey viruses already inoculated into millions of people in the polio vaccine was at best a long shot. But there was some evidence that anti-cancer vaccines were possible. Quoting Time magazine, Stewart and Eddie have gone a vital step farther and made a vaccine that protects a big majority of normally susceptible animals against the polyoma virus's effects, unquote. The odds of success were slim, but the stakes were enormous. Millions of Americans with cancer. They had to do something. They had to try, and they might get lucky. They might have serendipity. In a word, they were desperate. Eddie may have underestimated the government, or she may have understood them better than any of us. Either way, it looks like the government did spring into action, at least by bureaucratic standards, but the statistics suggest they failed to produce a solution in time. So if a vaccine was to be developed in time to prevent an epidemic of cancer in America, the research would need to be done quickly, quietly, and privately. And it would have to be directed by a competent professional. Someone with courage, someone with resources, someone with a reason, someone willing to take a risk. Perhaps then a vaccine might arrive in time to prevent a horrible and unprecedented wave of cancer on the American people. If they succeeded, they would be national heroes, praised by the press, welcomed by a grateful public, rewarded financially and socially for demonstrating that our beloved can-do spirit of privateerism really is an innate American asset capable of triumphing even in the mysterious realms of science. And if it did not, at least no one would have publicly stuck their necks out trying. The reason we reviewed these events is to try to answer one of our basic questions. Why would a prominent cancer researcher like Dr. Mary Sherman involve herself in an underground medical laboratory? Ferry and the angry Cuban exiles may have been willing to develop a biological weapon to kill Castro, but I personally do not think that Dr. Mary Sherman or the other doctors would have knowingly been party to the secret development of a biological weapon. I do, however, think that she might have been willing to be part of a covert effort to prevent an epidemic of cancer, especially if competent cancer researchers, which she personally knew and trusted, thought it was possible, and if she believed that bureaucratic politics or procedures were hampering the process at the national level. The key words are new and trusted, unquote. Just what were the connections between Mary Sherman and the people around her and the key viral researchers at NIH and NCI between 1959 and 1964? And are these connections strong enough to explain how an internal treatise on viral cancer research from NCI or NIH might have found its way to David Ferry's apartment? And were they strong enough to support the idea that Mary Sherman and others may have been asked by people at NCI or NIH to be part of a covert effort to develop a vaccine to prevent a cancer epidemic caused by monkey viruses in the polio vaccine? The most important connection between NIH and New Orleans is directly between Mary Sherman and Sarah Stewart. Both women entered the medical school of the University of Chicago as freshman graduates in 1936. Mary, 23, had just completed her master's at Northwestern and was working towards her M.D. Sarah, 30, had come most recently from Colorado and was pursuing a Ph.D. in bacteriology. Mary received her M.D. in 1941 and stayed in the Chicago area practicing orthopedic surgery until 1952. When Sarah received her Ph.D. in 1939, she moved to the Washington area for a job at the National Institute of Health. Mary Sherman and Sarah Stewart were friends and classmates in Chicago for 3 years. My guess is that Sarah Stewart is probably the author of the treatise found in David Ferry's apartment. Did Stewart send a copy of her cancer treatise to Mary Sherman? Now listen carefully to the names that are in the excerpt I'm about to read. Mary Sherman also knew Ruth Kirstein at NIH. Kirstein, who was 13 years younger than Sherman, was an instructor at Tulane Medical School in 1954 and 1955. During these years, Mary was an associate professor in Tulane's Department of Orthopedic Surgery and was that department's specialist in pathology. Both Sherman and Kirstein had common interests in pathology and cancer and taught in the same medical school. It's reasonable to assume that they knew each other well. In 1957, immediately following the polio shakeup, Kirstein went to the National Institute of Health, where she stayed for the rest of her career. At NIH, Kirstein began working as a pathologist in the biologics division where Bernice Eddy had worked as well. Her specialties were listed in the medical directories as virology, polio, and oncology. But since Kirstein was barely out of medical school when Sherman, Stewart, and Eddy were already nationally recognized authorities, I do not consider their direct contact to be very strong, but there are two things about Kirstein that should be kept in mind. First, once at NIH, Kirstein dated and later married Alan Rabson, who was Sarah Stewart's supervisor. And again, the names Kirstein and Alan Rabson should be borne in mind. Continuing. Therefore, she, Kirstein, was in a position to know things about both Stewart and Eddie's research that she might not have known otherwise. And secondly, Kirstein credits much of her professional success to the personal support and professional guidance of Tulane Medical School's Chief of Surgery, Dr. Alton Oxner, who is known to have enjoyed using his considerable contacts to help Tulane medical graduates find good professional positions. Did Kirstein keep Oxner informed about the research activities at NIH and NCI? It would be hard to criticize her for keeping her mentor informed about the progress of cancer research at the national labs, especially since he was the former president of the American Cancer Society and held many important positions in the world of medicine. Additionally, as an expert in polio who lived in New Orleans in 1955, Kirstein would also have been keenly aware of the problems that Dr. Oxner faced after injecting his grandchildren with Salk's polio vaccine. By the way, they got sick, one of them died. When Eddy and Hilleman broke the news about the cancer-causing monkey virus and the polio vaccine, it would not have been unreasonable for Kirstein to notify Oxner about the danger his granddaughter faced. Noting the coincidence of the time frame, we asked the question, did the sensitive position, unquote, that Dr. Oxner was cleared for in October 1959 have anything to do with a secret attempt to develop a cancer vaccine to protect the American public from an epidemic of cancer? There were other connections between NIH and New Orleans as well. Of particular interest was Jose Rivera, M.D., Ph.D., who sat on the National Institute of Health Board of Directors in the 1960s. We will note that Dr. Rivera was really Colonel Jose A. Rivera, one of the Army's top experts in biological warfare, and in the summer of 1963, he was in New Orleans handing out research grants from the National Institute of Health to Tulane Medical School, LSU Medical School, and the Oxner Clinic. It is not my objective to pin Ferry's possession of the treatise on any one person, but I am trying to show that there were numerous connections between NCI and New Orleans, any one of which might explain how Mary Sherman and or David Ferry wound up with an internal document from NIH or NCI. And later on, Ed Haslam points out that the Public Health Service in New Orleans, which is apparently where the linear accelerator was located, was investigated by the Warren Commission. The Warren Commission volumes, in the Warren Commission volumes, it is revealed that the FBI went to the U.S., in volume 19 of the Warren Commission volumes, it's revealed that the FBI went to the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital on 11/25/63, looking for evidence of either Lee Harvey Oswald or A.J. Hiddell. They went back for a second time on 11-26. Now, in that passage, note the names Ruth Kirstein and Alan Rabson. They are now married, and they were both aware of the Stewart-Eddy research on cancer-causing viruses, and Ruth Kirstein credits Dr. Alton Ochsner with much of her professional success. And bear in mind that they're married, and Sarah Stewart, or Alan Rabson, was Bernice Eddy's supervisor. In a document that I got from the internet, from www.nih.gov/about/director, this is a document called The Department of Health and Human Services, and it's a statement by Dr. Ruth L. Kirstein, Acting Director, National Institutes of Health. And again, this indicates that Ruth Kirstein is now the Acting Director of the National Institute of Health. Again, www.nih.gov/etc. In another document that I got off of the internet from the very same website, again, http://www.nih.gov/news/resident-priority, etc., we find the following on page 10. And there's a mention here that Al Rabson, the very same Al Rabson, is the deputy director of the National Cancer Institute. And again, bear in mind that Ruth Kirstein, acting director of the National Institute of Health, and Alan Rabson, the deputy director of the National Cancer Institute, are married. Rabson was Bernice Eddy's supervisor, and Ruth Kirstein, who was familiar with the same milieu, credits Alton Ochsner with much of her professional success. She was, in effect, an Ochsner protege. I'm going to review a section of an article in the July 2001 issue of Penthouse Magazine. It's called Cancer Warrior, and it's written by Debbie Bookchin, B-O-O-K-C-H-I-N, and Jim Schumacher, S-C-H-U-M-A-C-H-E-R. This deals with the aforementioned Dr. Michele Carbone, and this in turn contains some very interesting information indicating that Al Rabson, among others, was, to a certain extent at least, aware of the potential liability of the government in connection with SV40. Speaking of the study by Dr. Howard Strickler, which downplayed the significance of SV40 and was hotly disputed by many of the people who contributed to that, and speaking of the aforementioned James Goodert, Strickler and Goodert were so frustrated by the two dissenting laboratories' persistent refusals to endorse Strickler's conclusions that they considered publishing the study results without the lab's permission. Goodert ran that plan past one of the top officials at the NCI, Deputy Director Alan Rabson, M.D., in a June 1999 email to Strickler. Goodert reported that Rabson, quote, agrees we should no longer negotiate, but should send it in, unquote. But publishing a study over the objections of some of the participants is regarded as highly suspect in the scientific world. The Goodert email reveals he was well aware of the potential perils the NCI might face if it went ahead with publication. Goodert wrote to Strickler that Rabson advised first checking with the NCI's Office of General Counsel, quote, to assure that we, the government, is unlikely to be sued, unquote. Among other concerns, Goodert was worried about the potential personal liability, quote, if there is legal action, how much can, will the Office of the General Counsel help us? He wrote to Strickler and added, quote, is there any reason to think we need coverage from claims of misconduct, unquote? That would indicate that some of these people are perhaps more aware of the devastating results of the SV40 research than they are willing to publicly disclose. And again, note the role of Dr. Alan Rabson, the deputy director of the National Cancer Institute, in that particular gambit. That concludes side two of this almost concludes side two of For the Record program number 316. I've alluded to other broadcasts available from Spitfire. You can visit the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. And many of these broadcasts are now being archived on Real Audio by WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. There are two websites. Many of the For the Record programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Other For the Record programs are available for download only on another website, http://archive.wfmu.org/archive/D/X/. That concludes For the Record program number 316. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.